Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host for this evening, Ethan Elkind. Splashed across headlines in recent months are stories of women facing sexual harassment in a variety of work settings. These stories are disturbing, but nonetheless unsurprising, in traditionally male-dominated environments, such as newsrooms and corporate boardrooms. But recently, they've cropped up in the tech world. Within the last few years, women working at GitHub, Squarespace, and most recently Uber, have detailed experiences of pervasive sexism and harassment. The hostility these women describe is only one facet of the many challenges confronted by women in technology. Plagued by beliefs that men are naturally better at STEM disciplines, STEM being an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, even when they manage to get hired, women frequently are compensated less and have a harder time being promoted. Now, despite pledges by Google, Pinterest, Facebook, and other prominent tech companies to increase the number of women working for them, this population remains vastly underrepresented. So why does the tech industry, which prides itself on innovation, outside-the-box thinking, and novel solutions to problems, lag behind when it comes to hiring, compensating, and advancing women? What does it mean for women that these patterns persist in companies that dominate the landscape of Bay Area business and are likely to be growing for years to come? What efforts are tech companies making to open their doors to more women, and will they prove effective? Where they lead, will other industries follow? To discuss these issues and more, I'm pleased to be joined here tonight in the studio by Elizabeth Ames, Senior Vice President of Marketing, Alliances, and Programs at the Anita Borg Institute, a social enterprise founded on the belief that women are vital to building technology and dedicated to the advancement of women in technology. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Great. Glad you can be here. And we're also joined in the studio by Carissa Romero, a partner at Paradigm, a strategy firm taking a data-driven approach to helping companies to build stronger, more diverse, and inclusive organizations. With a PhD from Stanford, Carissa's work is focused on applying psychological research to solve real-world problems. Welcome, Carissa.
Thank you for having me.
And finally, we're joined by phone by Stephanie Lampkin, founder and CEO of Blendor, a merit-based recruiting platform that takes names and photos out of the early stages of interviewing job candidates. Stephanie has an engineering degree from Stanford and an MBA from MIT. She learned to code at the age of 13 and by 15 was a full-stack web developer. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation. We'll open the phone lines in just about 20 minutes, and you can reach us then by dialing 415-841-4134. And if you want to weigh in right away, you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. If you're a woman working in technology, what has your experience been? We want to hear your thoughts on this topic, so please do reach out. So let's begin by trying to get a sense of the current landscape for women when it comes to technology. And Elizabeth, I wanted to start with you. What are the basic statistics for women working in this field of technology?
Yeah, the basic statistics for women who are in technical roles, so women technologists in the industry, they represent about 21 to 23% of the workforce today, and that's within the U.S. They are represented at higher rates at the entry level, and that percentage drops about in half at the senior and executive level. So you see at the senior and executive level in technical roles, women are sort of more like 10 or at most 12%. So definitely a big decline there.
And in terms of getting promoted and retention and all that, what are you finding in your research?
Yeah, those are really the big challenges in terms of retention and advancement. You can see that advancement is a big problem just in that first statistic that I gave you in terms of entry level, the percentages, and then at the senior and executive level where it drops in half. Women are having a really hard time getting promoted. They're often overlooked. They're often pointed in the direction of roles that are sort of softer technical roles, so project managers or different types of roles that are not really necessarily the hardcore technical roles. And that has some impact on their careers in the long term in terms of the types of promotions that they might get and how far they will rise within the organization. So those are big issues. On the retention front, we see women leave at about twice the rate of men, and they really, they don't go to take care of their families. They go to other industries. They pretty much get discouraged and leave. The two main drivers of women leaving are lack of promotion and culture.
And are there particular industries that they tend to go to? Are they able to use these tech skills at all, or are they just basically completely dropping out of the field?
You know, it's a mix. And when let me just say that for the Anita Borg Institute, when we talk about women in technical roles and women technologists, we're looking at them at every type of company. You know, we sort of glibly say internally that every company is a tech company these days, and you would be surprised at the size of the technical workforce in industries like financial institutions, even retailers and media companies. You see more and more fairly substantial technical workforces. So a lot of times they will move into technical roles in, you know, those types of companies. But sometimes they just leave tech altogether and go into other types of work.
And, of course, at these companies, it's more than just the programmers. You're looking at a lot of, you know, administrative jobs, finance, communications, you know, all the big range of things. Do you track those statistics as well, or are you just focused on the sort of the STEM piece of it?
Well, when we really focus on the technical roles. That is really our area of interest is women technologists, women in technical roles. But, you know, there are a lot of different types of technical roles in these organizations. So you have kind of your classic R&D, research and development type roles. But you also have IT roles, so running the network, security of network, a number of things around those types of things. So you have a lot of technical jobs there. And then you also have technical jobs that exist in, you know, in essentially in sales and marketing, so technical sales support or different types of roles like that. And we look at all of those. They have to have a technical component to them, but we basically look at all of those types of technical roles, and we have a pretty specific description of the technical workforce that we provide to the companies that we work with, so that we're all comparing apples to apples when we talk about it.
And of course, we know as a nation we need more STEM workers, so obviously it's important just in terms of economic development and making sure that we have more entrepreneurs just by having more people of all types in STEM, but I would think particularly for getting women involved.
Right? Yeah, I think that there's a couple of really key points to make around this, which is, number one, there are all these jobs that need to be filled in the tech industry, and companies that have technical workforces everywhere are crying out for talent. So, you know, we really want to bring in everybody that we can and find the talent that's out there. And then the second piece around that is, you know, there's just a ton of research that says that when you have diverse teams, you get more innovation and you get better business outcomes. So I know that the tech industry is very interested in innovation and, you know, great business results. So I really think from that standpoint, they should be incredibly interested in diversifying their workforce.
So this is helpful to get a sense of the kind of overall picture. Stephanie Lampkin, I wanted to go to you. You've worked in the tech field. You know, we've gotten some good pictures here from Elizabeth as a sort of the general landscape. What were your experience and frustrations that led you to start your own company?
Yeah, so I actually have, it goes even further beyond my own experience. I had a unique experience of being exposed to a female computer scientist at a very young age. My auntie got her computer science degree from the University of Maryland College Park in 1984. And so I was really exposed early on, which got me coding so early and then going on to Microsoft. And, you know, a lot of the horror stories that she told me about her experience working for various tech firms in Connecticut were very similar to the experiences that I had at Microsoft and other companies, whether it be just the microaggressions or seeing differences in advancement or opportunities to find mentors, et cetera, between myself and male counterparts. There are a lot of parallels, but I think the fundamental difference is coming from a generation of women who we're more and more doing better academically and in a lot of other extracurriculars and aspects. And so I think our tolerance level for it was much lower than my auntie's generation. And so that's why it's led to what's now referred to as the leaky pipeline. But, you know, probably the biggest experience that I had that catalyzed the creation of my company and sort of committing myself full-time to a startup was interviewing after after I graduated, 6 months after graduating from MIT, for an analytical lead position at a pretty prominent Silicon Valley-based company. And I thought the interview went really well. I made it to the final rounds. It was it came about through a referral of a fellow MIT classmate. But the recruiter came back and basically said that I would be better suited for a more sales or marketing position. So very similar to the sentiments as she previously expressed about sort of pushing us towards more non-technical roles that lead to oftentimes fewer career prospects. But more than that, one thing that isn't discussed in this whole gender pay gap conversation is that, you know, these are often very significantly lesser paying roles. I knew the role that they were suggesting me to fill was at least $50,000 a year less than what I was interviewing for. So, so yeah, that really sparked my motivation to start Blendor.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, you know, getting passed over for promotions, things like that. You also talked about microaggressions. Do you have any examples of what that's like for a woman in the tech workforce?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard, you know, the personal testimonials of other women. I know my own personal experiences were things like interviewing for a role internally with my peer who was male, and we're at the same level. And you know, afterwards, not hearing anything back, and not, whether it be feedback or you got the job or you didn't get the job, and you know, following up for professional development recommendations, and just being treated as if you know, I just added no value, versus his experience was totally different. They brought him back and it was very engaged, and so there are little things like that that I've experienced, and things that, that people have said here and there. You know, I've had my photo, been told that my photo has been circulated around internal email groups, email lists within the company. Just, you know, the things that you hear happening in the media, I think it's more common than people realize.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's helpful from in terms of your personal experience and what you've heard. Carissa Romero, I wanted to ask you, you work with a number of companies. What are you seeing in terms of the work environment for women today in the tech industry?
I think there are a number of challenges. One challenge that I think about a lot that I think is often not talked about is the culture of genius that we have in the tech industry. So this idea that only, you know, certain people can be a tech kind of superstar. And what's interesting is that there's actually research that shows that when fields have this belief that, you know, only brilliant people can be successful, it actually turns out that fewer women and fewer people from underrepresented groups in general are attracted to those fields. And it's, of course, not because, you know, women are not brilliant. It's because we have an idea in our society about who is brilliant. We have a stereotype about, you know, what a brilliant person looks like. And if you don't fit that stereotype, you might be worried about being, not might be, you are worried about being viewed through the lens of a negative stereotype.
Mm-hmm. And where do you think this problem is starting? I mean, you mentioned this genius culture within the workforce, but do you see this as an issue that, you know, we need to start tracking even out to elementary school in terms of trying to, you know, give women the empowerment that they need to be able to succeed in the tech industry?
I do think this starts when students are in school. I think with certain fields, people just tend to think of them as being like, you're either, you know, a math person or you're not. You're either a science person or you're not. I don't think we hear people as frequently say, oh, I'm, you know, I'm just not a reading person, or I'm just not a writing person. And so I think those messages make it more likely that that people end up having these fixed beliefs about, you know, people's ability to be good at math or good at science, mm-hmm. good at technology.
And Elizabeth Ames, I know your institute has done research on this. Do you see this as something that that does go back to elementary school and you know, is sort of unique to the tech industry, or is this just a pervasive problem that we just happen to be focused more on in terms of tech?
No, I think that the point that she's made in terms of the stereotypes that people hold is very accurate. And I think that we have to acknowledge that, you know, that's just kind of the water that we swim in. Those stereotypes are out there. And let's be clear, there are women that hold those stereotypes of other women, as well as men who hold those stereotypes of women. So, you know, it happens in all kinds of ways and in all kinds of places. So getting people to let go of those are tricky. And you know, part of what we're talking about here is the unconscious biases that we all have. And there's been a lot of talk about unconscious bias. And the reality is that we all have biases. That's how we get through the day. We make leaps of judgment in order to, you know, make things happen on a regular basis. And so the tricky part is to be able to, you know, see when you're making those things like, oh, they're not really a good cultural fit. Well, what does that mean exactly? And how much is there just a bias in there? How much am I just saying, like, that guy's like me, so I think I'd like to go have a beer with him so he'd be a great coworker? Or really there is something quantifiable here. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's something that exists in culture overall. And so that's something that, you know, it's not just breaking it down in tech, it's breaking it down beyond tech. But hey, I think that all of us have high expectations of the tech industry, that we operate on a different level here in terms of being smart about things.
And Chris, I wanted to go back to you. We talked in the opening about some of these high-profile sexual harassment cases. How frequently are you seeing issues of sexual harassment versus other more subtle types of sexism that women might confront in the tech world?
In our work, we're really focused on examining a company's entire culture. I think, you know, in a lot of these cases, right, that it's clear what went wrong. Like, these are examples not of unconscious bias, but of explicit bias and of things that are illegal and inappropriate. But I think that stems from kind of a broader cultural problem, stemming from more subtle things like unconscious bias or a lack of intentionality to build a culture where all people, you know, can feel like they belong. So, you know what, I think that we are seeing when we go in and work with companies is that often, you know, well-intentioned people can create a culture where not everyone is set up for success in the same way, where certain people are less likely to have their voice heard or are less likely to, you know, just feel like somebody like them can succeed there, or less likely to be involved in decisions that affect their work. I think that's the kind of culture that's more pervasive. Those are the kinds of things that are affecting everyone. And then if you have, you know, a general culture that's just not being very intentional about this, sometimes that can bubble up into these more explicit problems.
And of course, some tech companies like Google and others have acknowledged their lack of progress on this issue and have tried to have explicit efforts and spend a lot of money to try to improve their diversity in their workforce, but the numbers don't seem to have moved very much. Do you have any sense as to why that's the case?
In general, I think we always want progress to happen faster, right? And I think with Google, they've done a lot of innovative work in terms of how they approach diversity. They take a really data-driven approach, but of course they're a large organization, and so it's going to take a lot of time for them to shift. But I am generally optimistic about the data-driven approach. I think that's something that it makes the tech industry makes me optimistic about seeing change in the tech industry. I think they're excited to approach this work in a different way. So instead of what I think a lot of companies do when they are thinking about improving diversity is they'll look around and see, you know, what are other people doing? I'm going to implement, you know, that program. But I think what's unique about at least the way we're kind of approaching this work with the tech industry and with other industries is we're really looking at the data first. So trying to understand, you know, where are unique challenges in the hiring process, or also, you know, once people get there, what are the unique challenges in terms of things that are preventing people from advancing or from staying in the company? And I think the ability to approach this problem in a different way is one thing that makes me optimistic that we will see change over time in the tech industry.
And Elizabeth Ames, what do you make of these companies' inability so far to make much progress on their stated aims?
So I guess I have a little bit of a mixed perspective on this. You know, you look at some of these companies like Google, like Intel, who have made commitments, and what you see in these companies is pretty consistent over the last 3 years, 1% increases in the participation of women in their technical workforce each year. So, you know, in total, that's about a 3% change. And while we can look at that and say 3%, not good enough, you do have to kind of look at the size of their workforce and really understand what is actually doable. How much hiring are they doing? I mean, I'll give a great example. Intel last year actually had some layoffs, and yet they still managed to increase their participation of women in their technical roles by 1%. That's a pretty tough thing to do when you're not hiring tons and tons of people. So I think we have to look at it a little bit more pragmatically in terms of what is actually doable. They're not going to fire a whole segment of their workforce and replace them, right? So that said, I don't want to sit here and sound like I'm the, oh, 1% is okay, because it will just take forever for us to get there. So you do want to look at it on a company-by-company basis. I do think that there is some progress being made, and I do want to celebrate the fact that there is progress being made, but I don't want to be satisfied with that.
It seems like a tough balance. It's a big industry, but we're hoping for a lot of change. Yeah. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight we're discussing the challenges faced by women in technology with Elizabeth Ames, Senior Vice President of Marketing, Alliances, and Programs at the Anita Borg Institute, Carissa Romero, a partner at Paradigm, and by phone by Stephanie Lampkin, founder and CEO of Blendor. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments, and we'll open the phone lines now. In your experience, do women have a harder time getting hired and advancing at tech companies? How do you feel about efforts to increase the representation of women in technology? The number to call to join that conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page, and we'll be checking those. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So, Stephanie Lampkin, let me go back to you. Your company has made headway in sort of scrubbing job applications of any sort of identifiable markers. And we know that in addition to women being underrepresented in the technology industry, that also racial and ethnic minorities as well are disadvantaged in terms of their representation. So I'm wondering, what are you seeing in terms of the interplay of both sexism and racism when it comes to hiring in the tech work world?
Well, I think it's consistent with any major equal or civil rights movement we've seen happen in this country. It's oftentimes led by white women, right? So I did an actual audit of 138 tech companies recently, for everything encompassing equity, inclusion, and diversity. And so we found all the board of director members and executives for all of these companies, and 80% of these companies do have a woman on their board, but they do not have a person of color, which is really, really surprising to find, especially for companies like YouTube and Twitter, which the majority of their users are people of color. Something like 40% of Twitter's content is produced by African American and Latino users. So it's definitely a different sort of struggle, if you will. People are way more comfortable talking about gender disparities than racial disparities. But the optimist in me is that as what has happened in history, oftentimes racial diversity will follow gender diversity in representation and inequality in general. But I'm really bullish on accountability. I know things like quotas and affirmative action are super dirty words, particularly here in Silicon Valley, but history has shown that unless there is some third party or governing body, these things don't really happen quickly or efficiently or effectively. So we're working towards just starting with data transparency, much like what Anita Borg and Paradigm are working with, but taking it a step further to see if there are ways that we can actually make companies accountable if there is clear evidence of bias or discrimination happening at every step of the human resources experience. So we do work primarily with sourcing data, but we're allowing companies to give us access to more data to identify if there's bias happening in compensation, in promotion, and other aspects of HR.
You know, I'm struck by those statistics you mentioned about how much of their users are people of color. And mm-hmm. you think that this would be an important business decision, right? That they're trying to reach these demographics. Don't they want to have more people who can understand the customers that they're trying to sell their products to?
I think the sentiment is if it's not broke, we don't have to fix it. And so it is broke. So a lot of these companies have became really successful with a very homogenous leadership team. But unfortunately, that's not how you sustain a fastly growing corporation. And so we're seeing that happen at Twitter and a lot of other companies that haven't made any effort to bring in leadership that reflects the demographics of their target user base.
And Chris Romero, on that point, do you find that at least the market argument of nothing else might sort of sway some of these companies to be more aggressive to remedy this problem?
I do think that presenting the business case for diversity helps a lot of people kind of get on board. I also think that there are a lot of companies that we work with that are working on this because they think it's just kind of the right thing to do from a moral perspective. But, you know, as we talked about already, there's a lot of research that shows that especially when innovation matters, when a problem requires creativity, lots of research shows that diversity leads to better performance. And that's not just kind of a correlation that we see across lots of industries. There's also lots of experimental research that gets at the causality of this. When you create teams that are more diverse and you ask them to work on a creative problem, they perform better. Mm-hmm. And I think that business case for some people really helps kind of get them on board.
Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, we've talked a lot about the conditions for women in the workforce and the needs there. I'm wondering now, I think people are wondering also, what are these companies doing about it? I mean, some of them are saying some of the right things, but Elizabeth Ames, can you run down some of the strategies that some of these companies are using to try to boost the number of women in their workforce?
You know, I think it runs the gamut. What we see is, you know, there are companies that have kind of gotten on the bandwagon of releasing some set of data of where things stand. We see companies that are deploying unconscious bias training. We see companies that are using a variety of different techniques to make the recruiting process more blinded of gender and race and ethnicity, that type of stuff. And let me just also say that Stephanie is spot on about the issues of race and ethnicity. And, you know, it is particularly true of women of color that they have an even more difficult road to hoe. So, yeah, so I think that there's a variety of different approaches. Some are more or less successful. And to be honest with you, the thing that we see that is really sort of the harbinger of whether companies can be successful is really their commitment at the top. And are they willing to put their money where their mouth is? Are they willing to reward behaviors that drive diversity and inclusion or not?
And Carissa, what strategies are you seeing that are most typically employed by companies to try to address this challenge?
In our work, we actually don't take kind of a typical approach when we work with tech companies. There are a lot of things that you could do. So if you look at the research on kind of what works, we actually know a lot more about what works than I think a lot of people are aware of. So you could update your job descriptions to be more inclusive. You can change your hiring process to assess for culture fit in a more structured way. When people are there, there are changes that you can make to your onboarding process that we know will be more effective. You can change the way that you do performance reviews. You can change the benefits that you offer. And so because I think there are so many things that you can do, I think it can be overwhelming for companies starting to work on this to figure out, well, what strategy should we use? What's going to be most effective for us? So actually, when we work with companies, we start by looking at all of their people-related data, from how they recruit, to how they hire, to how they develop and retain people once they're there. And then based on that data and based on what we know from all of this behavioral science research, have helped companies design a targeted approach. And then what I think is especially important for companies to do is not just to make these changes and then, you know, wait a year out to see, have our numbers changed, but to measure the most proximal outcome. So the first thing that you would expect to change. So if you make an update to your hiring process, if you change the way that you're assessing for culture fit, then you want to see at the stage that you're assessing for that, are more people from underrepresented groups now passing through that stage. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure you're understanding what's working, because otherwise, you know, you're not going to find out until a year later, and you might not know kind of why things aren't working, or if they are working, which of those efforts are leading to success.
So it seems like you need a lot of resources just for the assessment and the data collection then. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing the challenges faced by women in technology, and we're joined here in the studio by Elizabeth Ames, Senior Vice President of Marketing, Alliances and Programs at the Anita Borg Institute, and Carissa Romero, a partner at Paradigm. And we're joined on the phone by Stephanie Lampkin, founder and CEO of Blendor. So we do invite you to call in with questions or comments and join the conversation. You have three expert panelists here to ask questions of. The number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So we look forward to hearing any questions or comments from you, our listeners. Stephanie Lampkin, I wanted to go to you with this question of the types of strategies that you're seeing businesses employ to try to bring more women into the workforce, and if you have thoughts about what seems to be the most effective way to do this.
Yeah, so I find that a really effective strategy that a lot of companies now are employing is really just broadening the scope and outreach. So Grace Hopper obviously has been a huge, huge turnout for tech companies to find female talent, but they're also...
I'm sorry, you said Grace Hopper?
Yes, Anita Borg's Grace Hopper.
Oh, okay.
Annual event.
So, I'll let Elizabeth explain that after you finish, but I just wanted to flag that for listeners who aren't familiar, like myself.
Yes, and there are also quite a few coding academies, HackBright, and a few others that specifically target women. There are some returnship programs, so for women who may have been out of the workplace, whether it be for maternity leave or taking care of family, who want to come back and join the workplace. Quite a few companies are doing returnship programs. And then just flexible work programs in general. Power to Fly is an example of an organization where companies can find female talent if they're willing to allow them to work from home. So I think in general, from what I've seen, the biggest success has been in cases where companies sort of broaden their scope and where they're sourcing talent, and also the flexibility that they allow for women entering the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Well, those sound like a lot of good strategies for anyone working at these companies who's listening in. Elizabeth Ames, since you mentioned, I believe it was Grace Hopper, if you want to explain what that is.
Yeah, so the Anita Borg Institute puts on an annual conference called the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing. It was named after Admiral Grace Hopper, who was a real early computer pioneer and was an admiral in the Navy. The conference is held annually in both the U.S. and in India. Last year, we had over 15,000 attendees, and this year we'll have over 18,000. We, as a part of the conference, also have a very large career fair that takes place, and we have a lot of, about a third of the attendees, 25 to 30% of the attendees are students who are currently studying computer science, either at undergraduate or graduate level. So it's a great recruiting opportunity for a lot of companies to reach women that are in the field or interested in the field.
Mm-hmm. And when you mention students, you know, one of the things that I wonder about is, you know, how do we address this challenge if it is true? So I appreciate your thoughts on this. You know, if we're not getting enough women interested in STEM disciplines in early education, you know, what can we do to address the challenge at that level so that we, you know, grow the applicant pool?
Well, I'm not going to answer that question exactly, but what I'm going to say is, you know, we don't need to give up on attracting people at the college level. You know, we kind of have this mindset right now that, like, you have to have, like, programmed since you were 9 years old in order to pursue computer science as a career, and that's just not true. There are a number of schools that have done a lot of work in this area in terms of bringing more women into their computer science programs. Some great examples are Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, also Harvey Mudd, which is a private college in Southern California. Stanford has actually done quite a bit of work in Berkeley as well. At the Anita Borg Institute, we have a program where we are working with about 20 universities, and they are mostly state schools and, you know, sort of the lesser-known schools, but they have a huge student population, and we're working with them on bringing in the practices that have increased the participation of women at these other schools into those schools. And we've seen significant results, and one of the things that's kind of eye-opening about that that program is that it's not only increased the participation of women, but it's also increased the participation of underrepresented minorities. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is a huge opportunity to just address the problem even at the college level. And Stephanie also brought up all of these boot camps and other things that are going on, and those are also great opportunities to bring women into the field as well.
Mm-hmm. So lots of experiences we can build on. Stephanie, it sounds like you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I wanted to piggyback on that, which are all great points. One thing that's really important to note, which we hope to uncover with data once again, is that there are a lot of heads of engineering, VPs of engineering, CTOs in Silicon Valley that do not have computer science degrees, and many that do not have college degrees. I think we've built this narrative around the importance of getting women to get an engineering degree, but completely ignoring the fact that even a lot of men, a lot of white men that have excelled in Silicon Valley have not gone the traditional route. And so by continuing that narrative, I think we discourage women either from other disciplines or women that don't have the traditional path from sort of jumping in. But I think that's something that we can uncover with proper data to show that there's more diversity even among the type of people that are excelling here than we may even imagine.
Yeah. And Stephanie, since you mentioned, you know, your auntie had inspired you to get involved in it, what do you think is are promising strategies to try to inspire more women to pursue these careers?
Yeah, the visibility was 100% the reason why I went on to get an engineering degree. Had she not been in my life, there's probably very, very low chance that I would have gone into the field. So I'm encouraging as many women and people of color as possible to speak at conferences, to volunteer, to mentor, to even if it's within girls within their own family, because it was very influential in my career trajectory.
And Carissa Romero, I want to give you a chance to weigh in on this this question as well, about bringing more women into the field just from those early education.
Yeah, times. So first I agree with everything that's been said, and I think an important kind of thing to state up front is that, you know, because we're talking about how to get more women into the field, I think it's important to also note that, you know, that's not the only problem here, right? It's not just a pipeline problem. Women who are qualified, which there are many of, are less likely to make it through the hiring process. They face additional barriers that men don't face. And then once they're there, there's a less inclusive environment. So I think it's really important to state that. But then, you know, it's true that, of course, there are fewer women earning degrees in computer science. And interestingly, computer science actually is a field that used to have more women. Actually, right, starting in the 80s, that started to go down. And one reason for that that researchers kind of looked at is it's actually the 80s is when these like computer geek like shows and movies started to come out. And it turns out that matters. There's some really interesting research showing that, you know, when you decorate a computer science, a room in a computer science department at a university with empty video game like containers and a bunch of soda cans, and you put Star Trek posters on the wall, and you bring a bunch of people into the room and you ask them, do you want to major in computer science? Women are less likely to want to major in computer science when the room is decorated in this kind of stereotypical way, because it sends a message about who belongs in this field, who is this field for. And so I don't think that just affects you know, young girls that are thinking about what do they want to do in the future. But I think this is something companies should think about currently when they're thinking about attracting the talent that already exists. What does your office environment look like? Does it look like this kind of stereotypical male startup? How do you name your conference rooms? What are the pictures on the wall? All of these things matter. Who do you bring in when you're thinking about outside speakers? That's all sending a message about who belongs.
Mm-hmm. So all sorts of subtle cues there. Elizabeth Ames, did you want to weigh into what was just said?
Well, I just want to make a comment about, you know, these things that seem like little details become important, right? You know, what are you communicating when every time you have a team building thing, it's laser tag, you know? You're communicating like that certain people don't belong in a way. So it is important to think about these things. But I also want to make the point that, you know, if you want to positively appeal to women, really talking about how what you're working on is going to change the world or impact society or make a difference in people's lives. Women are particularly motivated by those types of things. And so talking about that part of the industry is very, very compelling to them.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. We're discussing the challenges faced by women in technology, joined in the studio by Elizabeth Ames of the Anita Borg Institute and Carissa Romero of Paradigm, and by phone with Stephanie Lampkin of Blendor. We'd like to invite you to call in if you have any questions or comments about your thoughts about women in technology. The number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can email us or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can reach us by Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. Stephanie Lampkin, I wanted to ask you, you have an interesting approach with your company, as I mentioned earlier, about essentially taking out some of the identifiable features of a job applicant. And one question for you is, is it the best way to get a diverse workforce if we're actually taking diversity out of the initial picture that people are getting with a new job applicant?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I get that question a lot. And my initial vision for Blendor did not include blinding out resumes, because I had the understanding that, well, if companies intentionally want to find certain types of people, then they want to see that to know that they're getting what they hope to have more of represented in their company. But it wasn't until I moved out here to Silicon Valley and started learning a lot more about the impact of a name on a resume. So even though my name is Stephanie, which is considered relatively American and non-ethnic, if someone goes to Blendor and sees Stephanie versus Lakeisha, even though they know we're both African-American, just because my name appears to be more American, I will be favored in the selection process. And so the biases that go into your name or the way you look or your perceived nationality, religion, even height and weight, right? There's so many things that factor into that. And so that's why we decided to pursue a solution that focuses on how to mitigate unconscious bias.
And are you finding any results so far that you can share?
Yeah, so we're working with 55 companies here, tech companies, and we've been pretty successful. We've led to a few dozen hires. We're actually working with some researchers to do some tests to identify whether there is a tangible benefit, like data that can back up that there is a benefit of companies hiring more diverse talent when resumes are blinded versus not, but we're pretty early in gathering that data.
Mm-hmm. But so far, it sounds like the response is positive from the companies that you're working with.
Yeah, unconscious bias is sort of the topic du jour right now, so we don't have to do a lot of education. Many have done some form of unconscious bias training already. you know, a lot of people know about the orchestras that adopted the blind auditions behind a curtain and the benefit that that had in increasing gender diversity. So we're more so focused on executing and having data that companies can use to measure ROI.
And, you know, we talked a little bit about the public goals that some of these companies have set. And I'm wondering if there is if you found that there's a stigma associated with having these public diversity focused hiring goals. Is there a stigma viewing it as affirmative action, and should there be one?
I don't think there is. I think Intel is the perfect example of a company, as mentioned, starting with the CEO. He announced at CES, you know, almost 3 years ago that this was going to be their priority. And I think there was some backlash among some employees around, you know, well, does this mean that there will be some sort of reverse discrimination, or people won't be, you know, lowering the bar, et cetera. But, you know, for the most part, I think companies that brand themselves as prioritizing diversity will see an advantage in their employer brand. There was something, a Glassdoor survey that said 67% of passive and active job seekers consider the company's diversity an important factor in evaluating a job offer. So I think this generation is way more social impact conscious than many others.
And Carissa Romero, on this question of hiring, are there certain good ways for these companies to build into the hiring process more assurance that they're going to come out of this with better gender equity?
I think one big problem that we often see is a lack of structure in the hiring process. So people often go into an interview not knowing quite what they're looking for. So when you hear somebody say something like, well, I just didn't feel like that person was a culture fit, and you ask them why, they're often not able to tell you that. So one thing that's really effective in terms of managing unconscious bias in hiring is adding that structure. So what that means is knowing what are the attributes that you're looking for? What are the skills? What are the attributes in terms of, you know, how you communicate or collaborate, and then, well, how are you going to get at that? What specific questions are you going to ask? And then what are you looking for in a person's answer? Because otherwise that thing can change based on whether or not you like that person's smile or they remind you of someone that you know. You really want to know that you're evaluating each person in a similar way so that you can compare apples to apples and so that you're not shifting your criteria based on who you're talking to.
Mm-hmm. And what about ways, other ways, like, for example, tying bonuses to reaching diversity goals or, you know, anti-bias checklists or including more women on the hiring teams? Are there other methods that you've been working with companies to recommend for them?
I think checklists can be really helpful because they remind people, right, to use strategies right at the time that those strategies are needed. So not just in terms of when you're actually interviewing, not just reminding yourself to focus on the relevant attributes, but also reminding yourself about, you know, what to do after the interview to make sure that you write down your feedback soon after, that you use data to support your examples, and that, you know, if you're in that meeting, reminding yourself to question people on what they're saying, to ask them to give examples. So I think checklists can be really helpful, and there's a lot of research on the impact of checklists, not just in hiring, but actually hospitals use checklists in an effective way to make sure that they're treating patients the same. So I think that is a really effective strategy. And in terms of, you also mentioned who's on the hiring panel. Of course, if you're a woman going into a tech company and every single person that you interview with is a man, that's going to not just send a message about who belongs, but it can create what's known as stereotype threat. So this fear of confirming a negative stereotype that exists about your group. And we know that one thing that can cause stereotype threat, which causes people to underperform, is having your membership in that stereotype group be really salient. And so when no one looks like you, when you go into interview, right, that creates that kind of environment that leads to stereotype threat and that can cause you to underperform relative to your true potential.
And Elizabeth Ames, we've talked about some of the positive things that these companies can do on the hiring front and other programs. Is there a downside to this in terms of fostering resentment? I mean, obviously, we want to promote more gender equity, but these companies have to worry about, you know, kind of introducing these programs in a thoughtful way to not lead others to be resentful for these specific initiatives. Are you finding any outcomes in that respect?
I think that is an issue that comes up periodically. But, you know, I guess I sort of have a visceral reaction, which is, oh, us women, we promise not to be too resentful of the fact that you've kept us out for all of these years. You know, I think we're not proposing that people go hire people that are unqualified. We're not proposing that people dumb it down. There are plenty of really super talented candidates out there. And I actually am, you know, an advocate of people being bonused on having the, you know, diversity in their teams. All of the research says that if you have more diverse teams, you're likely to have more innovation and get better business outcomes. Just as a general rule, I think that's something that companies want, and that's the type of thing that they bonus people on. Again, it's back to what behaviors are we going to reward. I don't think the intention is rewarding people for hiring people that are unqualified. That's not where we're going here. There are plenty of qualified candidates out there.
Mm-hmm. So this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. We're discussing the challenges faced by women in technology, and the number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our webpage or Facebook page, or you can reach us by Twitter at cityvisionsKALW. So we've got just about 10 minutes left, and one of the big issues that we haven't focused so much on, we talked about hiring and other methods to promote diversity, but a big issue that all of you have flagged at different points has been this idea that women are maybe getting hired but not staying. The industry has a problem with retention. So Stephanie Lampkin, I wanted to throw this one to you first. And what are you doing in terms of working with companies to not just ensure that they're hiring women, but also ensure that they're creating an environment that makes women want to actually stay in the technology workforce?
Yeah, so I actually come from a background around organizational behavior, a little bit at Stanford and even into my MBA. So I'm really fascinated with what factors contribute to people's success in different organizations. And so I'm really curious to find out, you know, what the promotion rates are, obviously compensation, I think, factors into it, but also how different individuals are communicating and interacting within their organization. And there have been a few studies done at MIT and Stanford that can figure out how different nodes are communicating, how often, the quality of the communication, et cetera. We've done all... Some people are already sort of auditing the language and their performance reviews, because I think culture is often used, but it's really difficult to quantify, particularly for someone who comes, who, you know, has my foot in a few different marginalized groups. So to say that I fit into a company's culture is a lot more difficult than I think most people. But there are things that can be quantified, and I think the closer that we get to figuring out ways to really map what makes someone successful in an organization, what makes someone happy, why they stay, then we can do a better job of figuring out ways to get diverse talent to remain in these companies.
And Carissa, I wanted to throw that question to you too as well. How do we make sure these companies can retain women who are in their workforce presently?
Yeah, one thing that we've been thinking a lot about in our work at Paradigm is a sense of belonging. Sounds just like a nice way for people to feel at work. But actually, there's a lot of research showing that if companies aren't intentionally focused on helping people feel confident that they belong at work, they're actually missing out on employees' best work. It turns out when you're not confident that you belong at work, what happens is you're on the lookout for cues to kind of figure out the answer to that question. So, you know, if somebody doesn't ask you to lunch, you might think maybe they just forgot, or you might wonder if this is a cue that you don't belong. If your manager gives you negative feedback, you might wonder maybe they're trying to, you know, help me grow, or maybe this is a sign that I'm not kind of good enough to be here. And so when you're spending a lot of cognitive energy trying to figure that out, you actually have fewer cognitive resources available to do your job well. In terms of, you know, how do you address that? What do you do about that? There are a couple kind of places where it's important to keep that in mind. One is when people are new. So during onboarding, that is a time when you're especially likely to have these questions. And if, you know, you look around and you see that there aren't many other people like you, those questions are going to be magnified. And we know that that's true. Belonging uncertainty is higher for people from underrepresented groups in any given environment. So when you're onboarding, you want to think about, right, how are managers interacting with people, for example. So in some work with one of our clients, we asked people that were new to engineering within the last year, what are some things that their managers did that helped them feel like they belong? And we found that it was actually often these little things that made a big difference. So one kind of story sticks out in my mind, this young woman who said that her manager a couple times a day would walk over to her and say, not just, you know, do you have any questions for me, but what questions do you have for me? And this like simple thing just made her feel like this is exactly what she was supposed to be doing. This was totally normal. She was a part of the team. And similarly, whenever she had to work with someone new, her manager would get up, walk over, introduce her to that person, and kind of start a conversation. So these kind of small things that we're doing when people are new are helping people answer that question in a positive way that, yes, this is a place where I feel like I belong. And when you don't have that question in the back of your mind, then you have your full cognitive resources available to show what you can actually do in that role. Another time, and this is important to keep in mind, is when you're thinking about social events. So if like every social event is a happy hour that happens after work, right? If you're a parent or if you have some other obligation outside of work and you can never go to things after hours, again, that might send a message that this isn't the kind of place where somebody like you belongs. Or if you don't drink alcohol and every event involves alcohol, again, that's going to send a message about who belongs. So, mm-hmm. So all of these things can influence, right, not just who feels like they belong, but ultimately companies' performance, because we know that belonging matters for performance.
And we do have a caller from Sandra who wants to make a statement on the topic. So, Sandra, we only have a few minutes left, but welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the call. I was just listening, and I really appreciate the topic today. But one of the things I wanted to convey is I am a professional who largely have worked in business, but early on, coming from the Bay Area, I was part of groups of women who grew up going through tech programs while we were still in high school, and this was late 70s, early 80s, but continued to work in more of the business side of finance and accounting, but largely working in the early days in tech companies. A lot of our projects were in operations and also in finance. One of the things that I'm finding today is that this, for example, like myself and women who have come through the experience that that we've experienced coming through the trial, we have a tremendous amount of knowledge in this area. However, I find that it's kind of a weird energy where this knowledge is not being tapped. Mm-hmm. And so I see a lot of things, and I appreciate a lot of the comments about unconscious bias, because I do believe that that's really important.
So, Sandra, I hate to cut you off, but we're just running out of time for the program. I really appreciate your comment, and I know the panelists would have something to respond to that, but unfortunately we're out of time, so okay. I'm sorry about that, but I'm glad we could squeeze you in just at the end there. So that is City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Elizabeth Ames, Senior Vice President of Marketing, Alliances, and Programs at the Anita Borg Institute, Carissa Romero, a partner at Paradigm, and Stephanie Lampkin, founder and CEO of Blendor. Thank you all so much for being here tonight. And thank you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, and to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Damian Miner, and tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney. Join us next Monday for another edition of City Visions. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.